Hello, everybody, and welcome to Season 5 of the Common Grounds Unity Podcast. Jesus valued unity and prayed for it. We believe unity begins with Jesus-centered relationships, gathering around a table, sharing a cup of coffee or a meal. We like to say unity begins with a cup of coffee. So grab a cup and let's get started with another episode of the Common Grounds Unity Podcast. So glad to be back for another conversation here on Common Grounds Unity. I'm Kevin Witham, and I am here with my delightful co-host, Veronique Weber. And we're back for another conversation. Veronique, how are you doing? How's all with you?
All is well. School is out up here in Boston, so it's a different ball game now.
Different ball game.
Good the summer rhythm.
Yep. Well, we're so glad. I'm glad to be back together with you. And same. I know we're both thrilled to have our guest today, Steve Staton. He's back with us. Now, Steve has been a guest on the Common Grounds Unity podcast. He's a good friend to Common Grounds Unity as a ministry and has done a number of things with us. But he's releasing a new book that is coming out called At the Crossroads, An Exploration into a Flagship Ministry of a Discipling Movement. It'll be published on Amazon this summer, so it'll be available to our listeners probably by the time this podcast might be being released. And Steve has done a great deal of research and, of course, lived through it experientially and has now looked at it from a scholar's perspective and done a lot of research and brought a lot of insight about this movement. I was a very young teenager when I started to learn of this church in Gainesville, Florida, the Crossroads Church of Christ, and what became known as the Crossroads Movement. So I'm intrigued by all that Steve has to say. Just a little bit more about Steve. Steve has over 25 years of experience in church leadership. He's been a minister, an elder, and over the past decade, he has served as an organizational health consultant with a primary focus on supporting churches. Steve has a master's degree in theology from Wheaton College, a master's degree from Lipscomb University in conflict management. If you want to learn a little bit more about Steve, you can go back to podcasts number 136 and 137 and look at that two-part series on peacemakers, conflict resolution. So, Steve, we're so glad to have you back. How's everything with you before we get started in the conversation today?
Very good. And it's an honor to be back. I promote Common Grounds Unity everywhere I go. My consultations, I point people to specific episodes. I'm proud to be connected to all of you.
Well, we're thrilled that you are. Thank you for your friendship and fellowship in this ministry.
Yes, Steve, thank you so much for being with us today. And just to kick us off, just want to know, can you please tell us what compelled you to write this book? And why is the story of Crossroads so important?
In May of 22, I was on a call with unity-minded ministers, teachers, men and women. There was a virtual call, probably about 20 of us. And it was a page turner for me because we were talking about pain in our association of churches through the historical discipling trajectory, 60 years plus in the making. And major crises and scandals in the news. And it didn't seem like we were all learning from each other and we were doing any better for the reputation of the Bride of Christ in society. And so I got off the call, called up a friend of mine, Robert Carrillo, and said, we've got to do something. I promoted an idea to about 140 of my friends via an email survey. And it led to the idea I would do research on movements of megachurches and faith associations had a crisis within the lifetime of their founders and try to reverse engineer why. And so I started with, I think, Crystal Cathedral Ministries, the Campus Evangelism Movement, the Shepherding Movement, First Baptist Church, Hammond, Indiana. Number five was the Crossroads Church. And I thought I was going to spend 2 months on each of these, which I approximately did on the others. But this has been over a year. It's a completely different thing because it hit me really hard. It's more personal. And I thought, I better do this right because there were subsequent movements that came out of this story.
Steve, in the book, you include a concise history of the Stone Campbell Restoration Movement. You highlight pivotal moments that led some streams away from its roots as a unity movement. Provide for us, if you would, a brief overview of the key moments and explain why they're relevant.
Yeah, and some of these are weaved in my story, but after the Civil War, the Southern Churches of Christ were pivoting in a direction of a hermeneutic, very different than the rest of the Stone Campbell movement, more about restoration than unity. And through the influence of the Firm Foundation magazine under Austin McGarry's editorship and other figures, I'm not sure I'm going to mention them all necessarily, but very polarizing figures that kept moving to more formulaic, systemic thinking, box-checking ways of packaging Christianity to be in the right church. And after World War II, it started to be very successful galvanizing the Northern and Southern Churches of Christ up into the 60s. And these polarizing figures did not all end well. Their reputations were damaged, other bad outcomes. And the campus evangelism movement between 66 and 70 was a breath of fresh air, moving the needle towards, hey, we're just some Christians. There are other Christians out there. And that became a really important. Another thing that's weaved in the story is the church that became the Crossroads Church, the 14th Street Church, was planted in 1950 by a church that had the first minister around 1911 of T.B. Larimore. He was one of the biggest bridge builders in Stone Campbell history. And his DNA was felt throughout the decades, but there were other turning points where people were trying to turn the Gainesville churches into the more strict, more militant aspect. So I think the church in Gainesville that's in the center of this story had those two streams working at it long before Chuck Lucas was hired as a campus minister. And so you see the battle for we are the one true church versus there's one Jesus and one seven ones of Ephesians 4. That kind of battle playing out in the background, even at conferences in the movement in Gainesville. So it's kind of rich to see the Larimore piece, the campus evangelism piece, and knowing that there was a departure from Barton Stone, Alexander Campbell, his father Thomas, Harding, Lipscomb, and others. And like, how can we recapture the better angels of our history? That's one of the things I kept thinking about.
Thank you. You mentioned earlier that it took a year for this project just because of your close connection with it. So I'm curious to know what approaches you took to really guard yourself from the biases that I'm sure will come up when you're kind of figuring out how to retell this history that's so intimate to you.
Yeah, it's impossible to write something without bias, but it's possible to eliminate as much as possible when other people are the collaborators. One of my first collaborators was a Roman Catholic who was an expert, or a specialist in surveys. So I came up with an 18-question survey, and he went through it to help me unpack the difference between the qualitative and quantitative questions and make sure they weren't leading. That was really helpful. I had something in my mind I learned a week in college, which is kind of the mental roundtable model. And that is, imagine that you're going to be presenting your finding with people that you agree with and disagree with. And the most important seat at the table is God, of course, but then your professors, your mentors, your friends, your enemies, your adversaries, so that you can give a really good answer for your conclusions. I think I also stayed curious. I mean, I asked a lot of former members, why you stayed, why you left, what do you miss, what went wrong, what went right, what should happen from everything we've learned. And a lot of the people I talked to, I would say about half, are no longer in a sequel, either in the Boston movement, ICOC or whatever. And there were the half that were and the half that weren't actually kind of have good relationships. And they kind of have a lot of agreement among them as to what really happened. So I read a lot of books. I did two major surveys behind this book, read memoirs, some of them unpublished. I read hundreds of journal articles. That was pretty significant. And I even did some AI queries. I did about 100 ChatGPT and Gemini and other AI queries. So anyway, that was all fun too, by the way. I did learn some things. My biases were exposed to myself along the way. I believe a lot of them.
Steve, you mentioned T.B. Larimore a couple of moments ago. I minister in San Diego, California, and one of the churches I served as the minister to for about 12 years, Larimore is credited with starting that church in 1892 and baptizing the first converts in San Diego. And then that church ended up being the church planting so many. And I learned so much more about him and his just Irenic spirit and grace-filled orientation, and think his influence. I would love to see that influence be learned of more and take hold in a lot of hearts. He had just a wonderful spirit. I'd love to hear his name mentioned. In the course of your research and writing, I'm sure you had many valuable insights. Share some of your kind of first big takeaways as you're starting to develop the things for this book.
Yeah, so I became a Christian after college. I mean, like a really, I was a very devout Catholic, but I was pretty screwed up as well. But I studied the Bible the summer after college, and I was 81. And then, and by the way, that happened to be the church that Thomas Albright was a co-planter of when he was like 18 years old. And I found that out years later and made strong connection with him. But
there's a great name.
Yeah. So, but then over time, I kept hearing the total commitment controversy. And I heard that working as an engineer, I didn't go to the full-time ministry to 88. I would hear that phrase all the time. Now I have a handle on it that's not just based on reading either side of the issue. I did a search on the phrase in every journal I could find and all throughout the internet and my books. And it turns out that Churches of Christ, evangelicals, everybody was using the term. And they were all using it properly about being totally committed to Jesus. So I heard that across the spectrum. Juan Carlos Ortiz as well, Robert Coleman. But in around 1975, Juan Carlos Ortiz published two books, Disciple and Call to Discipleship. And the second had the phrase complete commitment, and it meant commitment to the church. And then I started to find around 78 in the Crossroads bulletins and this idea of commitment to the kingdom, which means commitment to the church. And then in the 80s, who sets the schedule for the church? Evangelists. So it really means complete commitment to the agenda and the structure and the schedule set out by humans. And so it never meant that before. I couldn't even find one hint of a reference of that before the late 70s. And I think that was significant because you can see, or I could see, how hearing complete commitment could be translated as, I got to do as much as possible that's set out before me as part of the script of the church that I'm part of. But sometimes those scripts are undesirable, unrelatable, not actually wise. So I think that was a turning point in the late 70s. That was at least one takeaway. I had a lot of takeaways, but that was one.
I'm kind of speechless because that it has so many implications for today, for right. This generation. We hear so much about burnout. I can't keep up and schedule. I know it was mentioned students work failing, and we have students, you know, today in our churches who can feel similarly to that. So That is definitely something to learn from and to really ask some whys when it comes to what am I totally committed to when I'm looking at this? Yeah. Is it God or is it an agenda?
Right.
For sure. In retrospect, you know, what have critics actually gotten right? And what have they gotten wrong about the Crossroads Church and the movement?
Let's begin with what was right. Boundaries were crossed in relationships at times. Before it really became hierarchical, which is more a Boston ICSC era, it was this boundaries were being crossed with a lot of opinions And there was, you know, opinions about your romance, your spending, the time allocations. And that wasn't universal. It was definitely not ubiquitous, but I saw it. I saw it clearly. I've heard about it in my interviews and research. It definitely happened. But a takeaway that ties into what the critics were right about is this. In 1981, a prominent Church of Christ man by the name of James Woodruff was asked to come to Tempe, Arizona to moderate a debate between those who were behind the campus ministry in that church and the older members, you know, the legacy members. And by the time he got there, it was too late to moderate, but it wasn't too late to really unpack what had gone wrong. So he used the situation in Tempe with a crossroads kind of campus ministry and the traditional Church of Christ eldership. He put them against each other, and he took liberty to create a hyperbole, to exaggerate the worst of the campus ministry movement associated with Crossroads in the worst of the Church of Christ eldership. And he was kind also, but he did it in such a way to create a greater conversation in the brotherhood of the churches of Christ. I thought he did a great job. He wrote about it. That book is called Beyond Crossroads. And I've connected with one of the major players in the story, and he agrees with my findings. But basically, and this is extreme, okay, because this didn't play this way everywhere. It certainly didn't play out in where I was at, but I saw it, that the Church of Christ elders in many places were not involved in the lives of the members of the church and not involved in the lives of young people, so they weren't getting shepherded. And during this countercultural period, these kids are worldly. Some of them didn't have a church background. They were in all sorts of sin and drugs and whatever. And the campus ministry converts were filling in the place of where elders were at without the wisdom. Overly directive, overly opinionated, and crossing those boundaries. And he kind of eviscerates the extremes of both sides in the book. But I thought it was a great tactic. I would actually commend a tactic like that with somebody who has that ability to do that. But I go, he nailed it. We had two problems among the older body of churches and the way many shepherds were and the way that campus ministry people were stepping in. And James suggested that people should be allowed to fail, allowed to maintain their agency. He didn't use that word, but that's what he meant. And not be controlled, but be given that space to fail. And as a father of three kids, you know, watching our family, you know, adult kids between 35 and 40, that's kind of the way we raised our kids. But I really appreciate that. I spend a lot of time on that in the book. So that's the reason I'm taking some time here. Now, let me say, critics got wrong about the sources of some of the practices of the Crossroads movement. And they didn't understand the difference between when something's analogous and homologous, I think I pronounced that right, of common ancestry. So just as the wings of bats, pterodactyls, insects, and birds have some elemental structures that are similar, they are unrelated species. There's no connection whatsoever. And just because the shepherding movement or Watchman Nee's movement or David Cho in Korea had small groups, it doesn't mean there was a copying or a borrowing. So on Wikipedia, in critical places against the Crossroads Church, it'll say that the model came from Cuban guerrillas, the Moonies, Korea, China, Fort Lauderdale, Paducah, Kentucky. That's where the Maranatha Christian Ministries was before it moved to Gainesville in 79. I ended up talking to Jim Beavis about this. He's the last living, most credible person that could confirm my research on this. And he said there is absolutely no way that any Church of Christ, and specifically Chuck Lucas, would have learned from any of these groups. And had the Shepherding Movement's headquarters been across the street from the Crossroads building, there would have been no cross-pollination. And the books show it that way. Their interest in books were like 5% similar or less. And even the methodology came out of the church in Gainesville before it came out of the first meeting of the Shepherding Movement in October of 1970. And they weren't even a full movement until 1974. So like the small groups, for instance, that became Soul Talks. In early 1968, John Allen Chalk, a very famous radio person, also on TV for a short time with the Herald of Truth, came to the 14th Street Church when Chuck Lucas was a campus minister and spoke at a frat of about 50 people in attendance, a fraternity, for what was going to be like an hour. It ended up being 3 hours. It was on apologetics. And it was so moving that the idea was, let's replicate this in other fraternities with other speakers, and then the sororities, and then in neighborhoods and people's homes. And the term Soul Talk was very popular because of a song and in African American history and so forth. So they grabbed that term to, that's where we talk about our soul from a biblical perspective in small groups. Okay. So the real origin story for small groups would probably be the Book of Acts. But how they came about it was very organic, and just like prayer partners. There was no hierarchy in that till probably mid-70s. It's hard for me to pin it down, but and certainly not the way we see it in the boss movement until much later. But that came about because Church of Christ kids had never evangelized before. So when they were sent out at a seminar in 66 and 68, having never evangelized, they were intimidated. So they went out in twos, kind of like we see in the Gospels. They went two by two. What did they do? They prayed. They prayed for courage. And so they partnered. And that eventually became a one another thing, which was really significant in the early days of the Crossroads Church, the one another relationships.
Steve, was there anything during your research that really resonated with you on a deep and personal level?
Yeah, the personal thing I'm going to share before I share what I learned is along the way in my Christian life between 81 and the 2000s, I found myself in situations getting in bumps, conflicts, really intense situations with people that I knew if there was going to be moderation or mediation, it was certainly, most certainly going to favor a party, a leader. And there was always going to be a power differential, and you had to figure out how to navigate that without offering a false apology, but also saying, hey, this is the real world we're living in. And so that always bugged me. And it was one of the reasons I went into, got a master's in conflict management, and kind of the rest is history. But here's what I noticed. There has never been an agreed upon mechanism in the churches of Christ or the discipling movement or its subsets for transparent, just, and safe measures for resolving conflict that did not allow for power differential to get in the way. And by the way, I'm not picking on our heritage. This was true for the charismatic renewal that was cross-denominational through the 60s and 70s. And it was I documented some of these, and they're horrific because when you walk into a room and you can see based on who's in the room how a conflict is going to be settled, you know you have a problem. And so that's part, I think, part of the great tragedy of the modern Christian witness is, you know, Dr. Lowry once said on one of our podcast episodes, the most important decision a church can ever make is how they're going to make decisions. I would say one of the other things is one of the most important decisions a church can make is how they're going to sort out conflicts before they happen. And to have very safe, just systems operating by, you know, principles that everybody agrees upon, as and including who's in the room. And the lives of churches and individuals would radically be different today if this was part of our heritage. And I think it can be part of our heritage, not in mass, because it'll be hard to get everybody agree at a national or global level, but it can be agreed upon maybe at a relational or regional level. So, that's very personal to me to watch some really poor things happen over the last 60 years that could have played out differently.
Thank you. You write about the different books that influenced the Crossroad Church and the movement, whether it be Coleman's The Master Plan of Evangelism. Were there any like aha moments that came from realizing that the influence of these books, or just surprises that you want to share with our audience?
Yeah, Master Plan of Evangelism was number one in my survey. 54 people replied to a survey across the spectrum, and that's way at the top. There are some statements made in Master Plan that are really open to abuse, not intended by Mr. Coleman. Dr. Coleman is somebody I've met. I respect him. I'm not faulting the book. I'm just saying there are the statements, and I cover this in the book. I had to rewrite that section multiple times so as to not leave the impression that I was critiquing Coleman. But there were some people against that book that raised some issues that related to how Crossroads was using it. And I'll save that for the reader to go into. But it was basically, I would summarize, there are some people that have never been in the position of being in the role of having a bunch of disciples. Mm-hmm. You can't imitate that model if you're not mentally healthy, if you're too young, if you're immature, if you have power issues, you know, whatever, you know. So I would say that he anticipated it a bit, but not enough. And I don't fault him on that because, like, that's just... we've learned, you know, like discipleship movements today are so much healthier. Not all of them, but some of the more recent ones that have come out of the evangelical world and part of the Stone Campbell tradition, the Renew Network or whatever, they capture this stuff earlier. But I think it's because they've learned from our past, you know. But the other one, this is the big one. This is a shocker. I never read Competent to Counsel by Jay Adams. Frankly, I hadn't read Master Plan back in the day either. Mm-hmm. But Jay Adams' Competent to Counsel, I found as being very problematic, inserting some dynamics of discipling that were very problematic. And then when I surveyed 54 people and asked their comments on the books, that was the most criticized book. Because Coleman's Nuthetic Counseling endorses a very aggressive way to talk to people. And he puts mental illness and depression in a category of unconfessed sin. And so there's even some statements in that book that I heard throughout my Christian life. I go, so that's where it came from. So I would say, aha, okay, burn that book. Well, I don't believe in book burning because that sounds, you know, control, but privately we can do it.
Right.
Steve, as we bring this podcast to a close, we're going to be bringing you back and we're going to continue this conversation in our next podcast as well. But is there anything you'd like to add to what you've said that maybe wraps up some loose ends or state something that would be helpful to our listeners before we get away today?
Yeah, I would say there's something powerfully cathartic for me in talking to people that never continued the journey after they left Crossroads, or maybe after they left the Boston movement or whatever, to find new connections, to regain lost connections. In this process, I have mended relationships with people that we went different ways with. And I hope to create a conversational bridge in this book. I'm not going to mention by name, but I talked to two people that I might have even considered an enemy at one point. And I don't. Time has changed some things for them and for me, but I had to open up one conversation to say, I misjudged you. I had you wrong, and I'm sorry. And that ended up being one of the most fruitful conversations. And being a person who likes reconciliation and conflict resolution, I'm hoping this book will validate the transformative and the traumatic that's part of this legacy. And anyway, so that's the thing I would add to what you've asked.
Boy, that is a great positive to end with. It sounds like what you're learning, what you're offering, you know, the goal is to bring light, not heat, and to open eyes and hearts to one another. And boy, my prayer is that this book accomplishes those ends, so as well as many others. Steve, what a pleasure to talk with you about a history that's very intriguing to me, and one that I've both experienced and observed over many years. So I know it's enlightening to our listeners. Veronique, so good to be with you, and we look forward to being back, Steve and Veronique, together in a couple of weeks when our next podcast drops as we continue the conversation. Here on Common Ground Unity, we have a vision to create and support gatherings of unity-minded Christians around the globe. We would love it if you could just envision and imagine the good news of these gatherings, modeling the prayer that Jesus offered in John 17 for our divided world, that his followers might be one. If you're benefiting from Common Ground Unity, we ask you to consider making a monthly donation to support our staffing needs. You can do that at www.commongroundunity.org/donate. And you can find a host of resources there that'll be helpful to you as well as we continue this mission together. So look forward to being back with Steve and Veronique next podcast, and we hope you'll rejoin us for part two. Thank you for listening to the Common Ground Unity podcast. Please check out commongroundunity.org to learn about who we are and to find gatherings in your area. You can also subscribe to our monthly digital newsletter, join the Facebook group, or find our YouTube channel. Until next time, God bless, and remember, unity starts with a cup of coffee.